I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Cindy Gusak, co-founder and newly appointed executive director of the Collaboration Center Foundation. Cindy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So what exactly is the Collaboration Center Foundation?
So we are a nonprofit organization that we are founded in 2019. And really our goal is to serve individuals with intellectual, developmental, physical learning disabilities, serving as a centralized hub for disability services. So really a one-stop shop where they can reach out to us, and we serve as a case management coordination for individuals really from preschool all the way through adulthood, and to connect them with the services they need, whether it be therapy services, whether it be social groups, outlets for support. That all comes through us, and our case managers provide support for that.
Okay. What inspired you and your co-founder to start the Collaboration Center Foundation in the first place?
You know, it sounds like such a simple concept. And we say, you know, what we do is everyone deserves access to services. And you would think that there would be a centralized location for that. And yet there wasn't. It did not exist within our community. And in fact, this entire concept, really, we have yet to find any other place in the country that has been able to replicate this. Parents were having to call and they were trying to find services for their children. They were making multiple calls across the community. They were getting caught in a loop where they could not find something that would meet their insurance needs, et cetera. So we really want to become that centralized location where individuals could go to cut down on the wait times for services, cut down on wait times for assessment, and even when they did have to wait to get into a provider per se, to then give the support and the tools needed to be able to manage at home until that could happen.
And now you're the executive director. What does your new position entail?
Interestingly, not too much different than I was doing previously. Really, I am the one who both strategically and operationally oversees the organization. I like to say we are really fortunate. We have an amazing team of case management coordination individuals, and they are really the ones who touch the families and those who need support within the community. I'm the one who really just makes sure that it all flows smoothly, and then to also spearhead the fundraising side of it, because at the end of the day, our services are free. It costs these families nothing to receive services from our case management team, but then that's where we look to individuals and donations and grant opportunities in order to support all of that.
Wow. Okay. So you mentioned some of the types of services that you offer, but what are some of the specific programs and resources available to clients at the Collaboration Center Foundation?
So one of the things we're really proud of, an example, is our family inclusion programming. So we offer caregiver support groups where they can come and actually meet and sit with one of our licensed clinical social workers to receive, you know, tips and tricks of how to manage behaviors and to share some of the challenges that they're facing, because so often families feel like they're alone. We offer a sibling support group because, once again, so often these siblings feel like there are no others like them out there who share the same stories. So to be able to share those experiences and have social opportunities is amazing. We offer an adult social group. So we have young adults with disabilities who can come and socialize, and whether it be a Valentine's kind of dance and program or what we had literally last week, which was a family movie night, it's an opportunity to come together and just have a great time. And then we also offer which we're really proud of, is a vocational training program. So we have campus assistants. We have one in place. We have some others that we're going to be hiring later this year. And they really will stay with us for around a two-year period so that we can give them the skills and train through our cafe area and through our campus needs to give them the skill set to be able to go out in the community and be employed in some other capacity.
And what's the Pathways case management program all about?
So that is really the core of what we do. And it is a free concierge-like style service, and it connects individuals and families to resources at the core of it. The example I like to give that I think really best defines it is that, say a parent has a child in first grade, the teacher comes to the parent and says, "I'm noticing some delays, you know, I would suggest you go get your child assessed." And the parent then has no idea where to start or where to go. They go to their pediatrician. The pediatrician's offices themselves are overwhelmed. So they could say, oh, well, we'll refer you to this one location, but that one location may not be able to get them in for assessment. If they can come to us first, to our Pathways team, we will meet with the parents. We will determine what the needs are. We'll find the assessment for the child. Once the assessment takes place, the family then comes back to us and we help find them the supports that are needed. So, for example, there might be an ABA therapy for autism. There might be some speech therapy that's needed. So all those things are centralized through us, and then they really stay with us for as long as they want to be with us. So let's presume they are on a good therapy path, things are going well, suddenly their insurance changes and the provider that they're with no longer carries the insurance. They would then come back to us, we provide that insurance support and find a new provider. We also have state Medicaid on site with us a few days a week to provide those services as well, so that parents don't have to get on the phone and navigate that entire process by themselves.
Okay, and besides state Medicaid, who are some of the other on-site disability service partners that you have at the 5-acre campus?
So we have Let's Talk Therapy Services, which is our biggest partner, and they provide speech, physical, occupational, ABA, and feeding therapy. They are also in the process of getting licensed for developmental preschool that'll hopefully be opening this fall. And that is unique because there really is no preschool out there currently that is really geared towards the disability community. We also have Boys Town, Nevada, which does assessments for those on the autism spectrum. We have a New Journey, which provides therapy and support. We have an art center, which will be operating this fall to provide art services and art classes for those with disabilities. We have Serving Our Communities, which provides support to businesses within the community to support the disability community. And we have Children's Heart Foundation, which is a nonprofit, and they obviously reach out to those and support the community of those who have heart disease for those who are in the pediatric range.
How does a family become eligible or apply for services?
So there is no eligibility, which is wonderful because it is not insurance driven in any way, shape, or form. It is literally just contacting us through our website at collablv.org or giving us a call, 702-329-3208. And that will connect you directly with someone from our Pathways team, and they will reach out to that individual and start the initial intake process.
And, you know, it sounds like you've got a lot of stuff going on. So what sorts of opportunities do you have for volunteers to help out?
So it's wide ranging. We hold two resource fairs each year. Our next one coming up is Harvesting Hope, which is in November, November 16th. And that is where we open our campus to last year was close to 500 individuals and 40 vendors. Provide a resource fair and activities for those within the disability community. And we always need volunteers for that, whether it be assistance with parking or setup or tear down or directing our families. There's a strong volunteer need in that sense. We also have our annual gala, which is being held September 26th. It's called Night on Blanc. This is our fourth year doing it. And there are always volunteer opportunities for that as well, which range from, you know, actually setting up and preparing, but it can also, in terms of helping with silent auction and auction fulfillment, things of that nature.
Okay. So where could people go if they want to find out more information? First of all, about the Collaboration Center Foundation in general, sign up to be a volunteer, maybe make a donation, or if they're a family in need of services, to get started.
So our website is actually a great first spot because it provides the opportunity for all that. So it is collablv.org, and you can make donations through there. You can ask for support through Pathways Case Management. You can ask to volunteer. You can even sign up through our newsletter through there. You are also welcome to visit us on Facebook or on our Instagram page. And we are always continually checking that for messages. And those are, Instagram in particular, is a location where you'll see a lot of information about our upcoming events and programs. So people are interested in attending those can follow.
Nice. So once again, that website is collablv.org, short for Collaboration Center Foundation Las Vegas, collablv.org. You can sign up to be a volunteer there. You can access services through Pathways Case Management. You can make a donation, find out more information about what the Collaboration Center Foundation is doing in the community. All of that's at the website. Or you can give them a call, 702-329-3208, 702-329-3208, or find them on Facebook or Instagram at CollaborationLV. And we've been speaking today with Cindy Gusak. She's the co-founder and executive director of the Collaboration Center Foundation. And Cindy, it's been great talking to you, finding out all the things that you're doing in the community and the great resources that you're offering to individuals who have disabilities in our community, and all of it for free. That's just amazing. So thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about the Collaboration Center Foundation.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Only 1 in 5 people with disabilities, including those with autism, are employed, despite many having the skill set and desire to work.
Maybe it's because employers don't know what kind of jobs they can do.
Okay, try me.
What about a programmer?
That is a job for someone with autism.
What about a teacher?
That is a job for someone with autism.
Oh, how about a healthcare worker?
Yes, those are all jobs for someone with autism. The truth is, qualified people with autism can do a lot of different jobs, but often get overlooked due to outdated stigmas and beliefs. Businesses value diversity, but sometimes don't recognize the unique strengths and abilities of the autism community. Introducing WIN, the Workplace Inclusion Now program by Autism Speaks. We help businesses lead the way in inclusive hiring.
Ooh, what about a ranch hand?
Yeah!
Sure, that's a job for someone with autism too. To learn more, go to autismspeaks.org/win. That's autismspeaks.org/win.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Dr. Amy Lynn Safady, a pharmacy district leader for CVS Pharmacy. Summer weather brings fun and family vacations, but it can also mean sunburns, battles with staying hydrated, bug bites, and more. Dr. Safady, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what are some of the biggest risks that come from spending time outdoors in the heat?
Yeah, absolutely. So when it is the summertime, we're spending more time outdoors and it is very hot outside. I know we have a heat advisory going across the country right now. So when you are outside, you're sweating more. So there is a risk of getting dehydrated. So it's really important to make sure that we are drinking enough water while we're outside. And sometimes you might want to supplement that water with some electrolyte solution. So we have a bunch of different options, whether it be pre-mixed electrolyte solution or tablets or powders to add to your water in order to make sure that you are replenishing those electrolytes that you're losing when you sweat.
How do we know if we're getting dehydrated?
So if you're feeling dehydrated, usually people start to get, you know, a little bit dizzy, might feel lightheaded. You might be sweating a lot initially, but then if you're really hot outside, but then actually are not sweating, that is also a sign of being dehydrated. So usually if you feel those signs, it's almost gotten to the point where, you know, we really need to recorrect and rehydrate ourselves. So I would say best practices to make sure we're filling up those giant water bottles that we all seem to tend to carry around now and make sure that we are drinking throughout the day, especially if you're planning on spending time outdoors. And something that's another, you know, good tip that people don't realize is that you do actually absorb water from the food that you eat. So if you are planning on spending a day at the beach, you might want to pack some snacks that are high in water content, like cut up celery, cucumbers, or watermelon. And that way you can actually help to stay hydrated while you're also eating a snack.
And I know we're always told about how much water we should drink, but as you mentioned, we can get water from food as well. Do we also get water from other types of beverages?
Yeah, so it depends. So if a beverage does have caffeine in it, then something like, you know, soda or tea or coffee, I know it's liquid, but that's actually dehydrating because it does have a diuretic effect. So it does make you go to the bathroom more. So really the best thing to help replenish you is going to be water enhanced with electrolytes.
Okay. Now, what's the best way to prevent sunburn?
Yeah. So when it comes to sunburn, I know we have some options for treatment, but the best way to prevent sunburn is to wear sunscreen. So it's so important to wear sunscreen, even if it's cloudy outside. So when it's cloudy, the sun's rays can still penetrate through those clouds and can cause a sunburn. So many people think if it's not sunny, they don't need to wear it, but that's not true. So especially during the summer months when the sun is blaring every day, it is important to make sure we're wearing sunscreen and also to remember to reapply. So that's something that a lot of people forget about. It's not a one and done thing with sunscreen. So if you put it on in the morning, that's great. That'll protect you for a little bit, but you want to make sure to reapply every 90 minutes, especially if you're going in and out of the pool or the ocean, because the water does decrease the sunscreen's effectiveness.
And what about on the face? I know a lot of women will put on the sunscreen and then put on makeup or whatever, you know, do their regular routine. Do we need to keep reapplying every 90 minutes to the face as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially on the face because the skin is so sensitive, especially around the eyes and the lips. And it's always a good idea to grab a chapstick that has SPF in it as well, because many people often forget that you can get sunburn on your lips. So many of the lip glosses and lipsticks out there don't have SPF. So you really want to make sure to pay attention to the packaging. I mean, get something with an SPF on there to help protect the lips. And also, you know, applying sunscreen every day with your makeup, it also does help to prevent, you know, early signs of aging and wrinkles. So it's just a good idea to wear year-round, especially on the face.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, which types of medications increase the risk of sunburn?
So there's actually a lot of different types of medications that can increase your risk of sunburn. So most commonly, there are some medications that people use for acne that are applied topically that could increase your risk of sunburn, but also some common medications over the counter, such as anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, also different medications for blood pressure, cholesterol. So it's really important if you're starting a new medication to talk to your pharmacist and just to make sure if it actually does increase your risk of sunburn, that way you can be prepared with that sunscreen.
Okay. And usually it's just a matter of being more diligent on the sunscreen in order to counter those sensitivities.
Yes, absolutely. Also wearing a hat, especially if it's something that you're applying topically. Many people use things like retinoids to help with acne or signs of aging, but those can really increase your sensitivity to the sun. So besides sunscreen, also a good idea to wear a hat just to keep your face shaded and decrease that risk of getting a sunburn.
Okay. Now, how should we treat rashes or insect bites?
But when it comes to rashes or bug bites, it's always a good idea to keep some hydrocortisone and calamine lotion in your medicine cabinet, especially for bug bites. So right now, as the weather's getting warmer, the sun's staying up longer, and the mosquitoes are out and they are biting. So it's definitely a good idea to keep some hydrocortisone cream as a topical steroid that you can apply to the bite because that helps to soothe that itch. Now, when it comes to rashes, sometimes if you're out now in the summer and hiking, you might come in contact with something like poison ivy or poison oak. And when that happens, it does have an oily rash that does tend to spread all over the body. So the best thing to combat that is to keep a poison ivy wash on hand. And this is a special wash that's formulated to get those oils off of the skin so that way it stops spreading.
Now, when you talk about calamine lotion, it brings back memories of being a kid with all these patches of bright pink all over me where I got bit by bugs. Is it always that bright pink or do we have other alternatives now?
Yeah, so we actually do have a clear calamine lotion now too. And, you know, I have those same memories when I had the chicken pox as a kid covered with pink spots everywhere. So, you know, we'd have something a little bit more aesthetically pleasing now, especially for, you know, adults and children. So we do have clear calamine lotion, which can be applied and that does help to soothe that itch.
Nice. Okay. Now you've mentioned a few times that we can ask the pharmacist for help. How can the experts behind the counter help us stay healthy?
Yeah. So when you walk into your CVS pharmacy, our pharmacists are there to help you and be able to recommend products that are available right over the counter. So they'll be able to assess and see, you know, what you're needing help with. If it is something that can be treated with an over-the-counter item, we're there to recommend it to you right there on our shelf. So you can purchase it and go on and enjoy the rest of your summer.
So where can listeners go to learn more about staying healthy during the summer?
Yeah. If listeners have more questions, you can visit cvs.com to find the closest CVS pharmacy near you.
Okay, cvs.com. Once again, is that website for CVS Pharmacy, cvs.com. Plenty of locations all around the valley, and you can obviously find your closest one there as well, cvs.com. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Amy Lynn Safady. She's a pharmacy district leader for CVS Pharmacy. And Dr. Safady, I want to thank you so much for being here and bringing us these timely summer tips to help people stay healthy and happy during their summer activities. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I hope you enjoy the rest of your summer.
Most of us like to be out in the sun. That's why sunscreen and other safety measures are key to protecting your skin from aging and cancer. The FDA recommends using a sunscreen with a sun protection factor, or SPF, of 15 or higher. Also, look for broad spectrum on the label. That means both harmful ultraviolet A and B rays are blocked. UVA rays age the skin, UVB rays burn, and both cause cancer. But the perfect sunscreen doesn't count if you use it wrong. Don't need sunscreen on a cloudy day? Wrong. 80% of UV rays still get through the haze. Only use sunscreen at the beach? Nope. Anytime you're outside, UV rays attack the skin, so you need protection. And you have to reapply sunscreen every 2 hours. Remember, SPF plus broad spectrum equal healthy fun in the sun. Visit www.fda.gov/sunscreen for more information. A message from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Marissa McGrady, a content creator and social media influencer known as the Fairy Godmother, and author of the new book, The Fairy Godmother's Growth Guide, Whimsical Poems and Radical Prose for Self-Exploration. Marissa, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Heather. I'm really excited to be here.
So what inspired you to write your new book, The Fairy Godmother's Growth Guide, Whimsical Poems and Radical Prose for Self-Exploration?
Well, it was really a combination of two things, if I can narrow it down. The first is I have been creating these rhyming poems to encourage body acceptance and self-acceptance and getting back to having some childlike wonder about the world for several years online. And I wanted to have a place that took all the poems I had written and offered it in one area in a print form. So that way, anyone who found comfort in them had a one-stop shop, kind of, where they could go and find all the different kinds of poems. And the other thing that really moved me to write this book and is more representative of the prose sections of the book is that I wanted to talk about my own experiences overcoming self-hatred and working towards self-love from an accessibility standpoint as someone with PTSD and ADHD, because I think a lot of modern media and dialogues around self-love have accessibility issues that don't really get addressed, particularly on social media. So I wanted to provide just some different frameworks and perspectives to help people who might have had similar experiences move through self-hatred and try to get to a more accessible, sustainable version of self-love.
Okay, so from your perspective, what is the importance of self-exploration, self-love, and self-care?
Well, I think at the end of the day, for anybody, regardless of your ability levels, your age, your culture, it's important to explore who you are on your own terms, especially in the time that we're in now with so much information readily at our fingertips. It's a gift to have all of the resources that we have and to have access to so many people's opinions and so much research. But when you start to place emphasis and priority on research, on everyone else's opinion, on literature from all kinds of different sources, you can kind of forget the importance of self-trust, of going within and saying, well, all of these resources say that this information is correct or that this framework would suit someone best, but how do I actually feel about that internally? And if you don't spend time exploring, you know, your emotional responses to different things, your intellectual curiosity, it's difficult to, when the time is necessary to do so, know how to begin. It's hard to know how you're responding to something emotionally and what that means and why and what you can do with that actionable information if it's not a practice that you're regularly in. And so I think that self-exploration for me is so important because it's how you establish a baseline of self-trust where you can say, hey, even if overwhelmingly lots of different resources say this is the best way to do something, I've sat with it, I've tried it, and I know that that's not going to work for me. And I trust myself enough to know that that's a valid response and that's okay. It's not morally wrong for me to disagree with these resources as long as I'm not doing harm to anybody else or to myself, and I'm not. So I'm going to trust myself to figure out a different way for me. And I think that that's important, not just in self-love, but it's important in your interpersonal relationships. It's important in your career. It's important if you're a spiritual person or a religious person in figuring out your relationship with the divine. It's important in family relationships. It's just that baseline of self-trust will take you so far. But if you don't know how to go within and listen to yourself, or if you don't know how to prioritize your own perspective over the opinions and information of everybody else externally, it can be really difficult to do. So I think that finding frameworks that make it easier to understand and kind of can guide you through the process are just vital to establishing one of the fundamental things you need to get through life, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, self-care sounds like it should be super simple, but besides not knowing how to do it, what typically gets in the way of self-care?
In my experience, the things that have tended to get in the way the most, and also what I've heard from most of the people that I've spoken to over several years across a lot of different backgrounds, are access issues, particularly economic access issues. For example, when people think of self-care, I think they mostly think of skincare, of eating healthy, of exercise, of relaxation, you know, doing things like meditating or getting a massage or taking a bath, which are all very important aspects of self-care. But I don't think people often consider the resources necessary to achieve those things and include time as a resource. Because even if you have the money, for example, to eat really healthy food, or you have the money to go to a nice gym or to get someone like a personal trainer to help you with your exercise regime, or even have the money in a simpler way to get prescription medication if you need it to help with your health, if you don't have time to dedicate to going to the gym, to making healthy food, to working on your sleep schedule, to doing a skincare routine, no matter how simple it is, at the end of the day, you're not going to be able to engage in self-care if you don't have enough of that resource, time. And I think it's pretty well understood that people who struggle with access to free time are often blocked because of economic reasons. Like they have to work multiple jobs or they have family members that they need to care for. And so when you're put into a position in which you have to choose between, let me take some time for myself, even if it's not for a relaxation-based purpose, even if it is, let me take some time for myself to cook a meal and make sure I eat, or let me take some time for myself to make sure that I shower at all today, or I could make an extra $20 if I go do this job for an hour. And that $20 is the difference between making your mortgage that month or, you know, perchance foreclosing on your house. You're going to make the choice that keeps you from foreclosing on your house. And so in that way, self-care can be really, really difficult. And I think it's something that a lot of people ultimately end up blaming themselves for and saying like, oh, I'm doing such a bad job at taking care of myself. I should work harder at this. I should be more dedicated to this. And they don't give themselves a lot of grace in recognizing that time is a resource and a privilege that not everyone has in equal amounts. And so when you look at self-care, it's not just about, do you have the dedication? Do you have the discipline? It's also, let's look at your life and see, do you have the resources you need truly to take care of yourself? And if you do, how are you using them? Have you been taught how to use them? And if you don't have the resources to take care of yourself in a way that, you know, perhaps lots of modern media would recommend, how can we look at what you do have, even if it's very, very minimal, and make it work? So that way, at the very least, you are sleeping a little bit, you are eating anything at all, you are cleaning yourself in ways that you can when you can, even if you only have 1 minute to yourself each day. And that's a very extreme example, but it does exist. It is real. So I would say economic access issues, time, looking at physical resources, like do you have the money to buy soap? Do you have the money to buy broccoli? And then also just do you have the ability to engage in the activities that are required to care for yourself, which is very related to how much time you have or don't have.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you've been able to give your poems to a real audience on social media and test the response in real time. So how exactly do your poems inspire readers to see themselves in a different light?
With the blessing and privilege of, you know, having shared these poems over a few years with folks online, I do have some feedback in terms of how people receive different poems and how it helps them see themselves in different lights. And then I also have that combined with what I know I'm trying to achieve with my intentions as the author. And I think ultimately what I'm trying to do is just make conversations about self-image, body image, more fun in general, because so often, even if we're having positive conversations about body image, they're really heavy. They're really intense because it is a very heavy and intense subject for all of us at different times in our lives and for some of us throughout our whole entire lives. And so acknowledging that is valid and important and necessary. But for me, it kind of got to a point where I was like, well, if every single conversation about this subject is heavy, even when it's positive, I'm always going to feel intense about this. And I think as I've grown, I wanted to find a way to engage with it in a more lighthearted sense, to have a sense of ease in the positivity approaching body image and not be so intense one way or the other, whether it's positively or negatively about myself. And I hope that these poems help people find that ease, that if someone reads these poems and they're like, that's so silly, that's so, you know, why would I think that? Great. Consider silliness as an alternative, you know, and so that's kind of one of the aspects to it. And then the other is very simplistic, just in that you don't know what you don't know. And so for some people, they have never thought about the fact that they could consider something like their nose or their arms or their cellulite beautiful. And I want to provide literature that in very simple terms, so very accessible terms, not as a metaphor, not as anything, you know, allegorical, but in very straightforward, direct terms says, hey, have you ever thought about how this part of your body looks like art or looks like some of the most beautiful parts of the natural world? Or have you ever thought about how these things on your body are things that many folks don't often notice about you or that don't impact your worth as a human being? And so these very basic concepts, I wanted to make them as accessible and easy to comprehend as possible for folks who may have never heard that before in their lives, who may not have grown up with anybody who offered that as a framework for thinking about themselves, whether that was, you know, not hearing it in your local community or not hearing it at home or wherever it was. We take for granted, I think, some of the positive support that we have in our lives. And so there are things to us that's like, oh, well, my mom has called me beautiful. Oh, she's just my mom. She has to do that. Well, for some folks, that's not the case. And so I really wanted to provide these very bare bones kind of concepts of, hey, if you have never even considered that you're allowed to think this thing about you is good because you've only ever been told it's bad, here is someone who's telling you it's good and that it's okay for you to say it's good and that it can be as simple and as fun and silly as that. And so I kind of hope that that's how the poems help the readers reframe their relationships with themselves or at least consider new alternatives that they haven't heard before.
Yeah, nice. And then what types of insights can be gained from your prose sections?
I would say that the biggest thing the prose sections offer is clarity. It's a blessing to live in the digital age and to have access to so much information, to so many resources, but it's also a bit overwhelming. You know, it's not like a few decades ago where you would go to one encyclopedia at the local library and you would have your definition for a concept. There are so many definitions. Some of them are legitimately recognized by different educational resources. Some of them are not. Some of them are evolving as we evolve and explore new subjects. And it can get really hard when you're trying to do what I mentioned earlier, which is understand yourself and understand your opinions on things, if you don't even fully know what the thing is that you're trying to learn about, right? Because it's so convoluted. And so with the prose, I hope to clarify the definitions for self-love, for self-care, for self-esteem, for self-worth, for self-concept, for self-regulation, for self-evaluation, for self-trust. And to state in a very easy to understand way that these are the functional definitions that I'm using. I've used these resources to create them. And here's what that looks like in action. This is what has been the most easily accessible and implementable in my life. But you don't have to use these resources. And so I hope to just offer like a starting point for research and for clarity for people ultimately creating their own definitions and frameworks and understanding of these concepts. But you know, that's really hard to do if you're starting from scratch and you're looking for help. So I wanted to create a very clear, very easy one-stop shop resource that gave starting definitions that explained this is what this looks like in action. This is how you can apply it to your life. And here are more things to consider as you learn how to trust yourself and empower yourself to create your own definitions and your own systems. So that's kind of what I would say the prose sections offer that I consider more important than anything else. There's also other things in there, like small tips, lots of humor. Well, lots of things I find funny. I hope the readers find them funny too. And then lots of encouragement and love as well, because I think some people engage with self-help books or things like what I do in my writing or online, and they say, well, this is so cheesy and who needs this? And to that, I would say, well, that's wonderful that you don't need it, because that shows me that you do have a lot of love and lightheartedness in your life. But there are some people who don't, and there are some people who do need this. And I used to be one of those people, and I would have loved to have a resource like this when I was younger. And so I hope that in that way, it can be a resource for love as well as clarity and self-empowerment.
Yeah, awesome. So you've provided a lot of important info around self-exploration, but as the fairy godmother, What do you see as the biggest secret to living a more magical life?
I think you have to just be open to magic, because if you allow yourself to look for it and be open to it, I truly believe it's everywhere. I go on walks in the morning as often as I can, and I will stop just so often on a walk because I'll see the sunlight hit a leaf in a certain way, and I'll be able to see the veins on the underside of the leaf in a way I've never seen them before. And to that moment, the sun coming through the trees in exactly the way that it did, at exactly the time that it did, while I was on my walk in the place that I was, to see a new aspect of life that I've never been able to see and appreciate before, that to me is so magical. When I make my breakfast in the morning and I get to taste my scrambled eggs with spinach and turmeric and cheese, and I have that experience every morning of, wow, I had time to make this and this tastes so wonderful and I'm able to enjoy this moment, that to me is so magical. When I see one of my friends and I see their faces move in real time, even if like it almost doesn't matter what we're talking about, I see their face move and I hear their voice and I'm struck all at once by, oh my gosh, this is this living, breathing human being across from me that is their own entire world, and I have the honor and privilege to stand in front of them and engage with them and learn from them and be with them. And that is so magical. And so I just think to make life more magical, you have to just be open to the fact that it exists all around you if you are open to seeing it as magic. So that's why I say, you know, find magic in the mundane, because it's there.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So where can people follow you on social media or get your new book, The Fairy Godmother's Growth Guide, Whimsical Poems and Radical Prose for Self-Exploration?
Well, on social media, you can follow me on Instagram, on TikTok, on YouTube. My name is Marissa McGrady, but my username on most platforms is riss.writes, so RIS.WRITES. And to find my book, if you Google my name, Marissa McGrady, or The Fairy Godmother's Growth Guide, it will pop up online, and it's distributed by Simon & Schuster, so you can get it at Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Amazon. You can order directly from Simon & Schuster's website, or if you go into your local Barnes & Noble or bookstore, they should be able to place an order for you, so that's where you can find the book.
Nice. Okay. So once again, the book is called The Fairy Godmother's Growth Guide, Whimsical Poems and Radical Prose for Self-Exploration. You can Google The Fairy Godmother's Growth Guide or Google Marissa's name. It's M-A-R-I-S-A, last name McGrady, M-C-G-R-A-D-Y. The book is available at any book dealer that you like to shop at, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And if you'd like to follow her online, she's on Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, YouTube, mostly under riz.writes. So Riz, short for Marissa, RIS.writes, Riz Writes. And we've been speaking today, of course, with Marissa McGrady. She is an online influencer known as the Fairy Godmother or Riz.writes, and also the author of the new book, The Fairy Godmother's Growth Guide, Whimsical Poems and Radical Prose for Self-Exploration. And Marissa, I want to thank you so much for being here and providing this great insight, you know, you shedding the light on your story, your experience, and how you've been able to create this resource to inspire other people has been really inspiring in the moment as well. So thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it. And you are so incredibly kind and gracious. Truly, thank you. It's been a wonderful experience being here.
Miles, you're late again.
You are not living up to your full potential.
No sense of responsibility.
This is Kevin Love. I've partnered with The Spider Within, a Spider-Verse story to let you know that everyone's going through something, even superheroes.
You're not reaching your full potential.
Unacceptable, Miles.
Let's take the stigma out of asking for help.
Hey, Dad, you got a minute?
Yeah, what's up, son?
I just got so much on my mind, you know?
If you need support, visit kevinlovefund.org to learn more.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Brian Moody, executive editor of Kelley Blue Book. Families come in all sizes, but their priorities are consistent, including safety, reliability, and value. So which vehicles are best equipped to handle your most precious cargo? Brian, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So what exactly is Kelley Blue Book?
Kelly Blue Book is a couple of things. It is a valuations and pricing company. So there's the actual book that used to be published, and dealers would use that and consumers would use that to find the values and prices of their cars. But it's also a consumer facing website that has car reviews, how much you should pay for your next car, how much is your car worth, videos, buying advice, what to do when you have an accident, what kind of car should you buy next, all of those types of typical automotive advice type things that you would find online.
So which vehicles topped this year's best family cars list?
Well, we broke it down by a couple of different categories. So one thing to consider, there's 12 cars on the list in all, and you can see those by going to kbb.com/awards. You have to consider whether or not, when it comes to family cars, do you need a two-row vehicle or a three-row vehicle? So a two-row, one thing we think is good, is like a Honda CR-V. That's a small SUV with two rows of seating. We also like the Hyundai Ioniq 5, which is an electric car, electric small SUV, as well as the Subaru Outback. Those are two-row SUVs. For three rows, we like the Ford Expedition, the Honda Odyssey, the Honda Pilot, the Hyundai Palisade, the Hyundai Santa Fe, the Toyota Highlander, and the Toyota Sienna. And my favorite of all those is the Kia Telluride. The Kia Telluride is kind of boxy looking. It's great inside. It's great outside. I love the way it drives. It's just one of those vehicles that it's like the Three Bears story. When you get inside, you're like, oh, this is just right. The Toyota Sienna is also a good family van. But remember, here's something to keep in mind. Today, if you haven't bought a new car for a while, the Sienna comes only one way, and that's as a hybrid. So hybrids get way better fuel economy than cars that are not hybrids, but that's the only way that one comes. If you don't like that, you probably aren't going to want a Sienna, but it should just result in lower fuel bill for the average family. So those are some of the cars that we think are good for families. And of course, there are many others that you should test drive and make sure that our picks line up with what your family needs.
Generally speaking, what are the most important features to consider when choosing a new family car?
You have to consider what level of technology you want, what level of safety features you want. So there's a lot of new things. Rear parking assist is one of these things, or cross traffic alert. If you're backing up and the sensors see an object, whether it's a kid's bike or whether it's a plant or whatever it is, it will automatically stop the car for you. Some people don't like that. They feel it's intrusive. A camera that you, where you can see behind you, is good enough. So consider whether you like that. Many cars now have the option of forward collision warning, or a step further is forward collision mitigation. So warning just sounds an alarm and says, hey, you might be hitting that car ahead of you, so slow down. Mitigation means it will actually apply the brakes for you. Again, you can see how certain people would be like, oh, I don't want that. Mm-hmm. I would never want a car to take over, because people know more than computers, right? So think about that, and then think about the how many seats you need, and think about the size of car that you need, and the importance of features like fold flat seating, and do you want screens in the back seat? Some parents, they don't want any screens in the back, because they're like, that's the whole point we're going on a vacation with the family, is so that they won't have their screen. Others feel like it's a needed distraction for littler kids when you're on a long road trip that can be kind of boring for anybody who's under, oh, I don't know, 30 years old, let's say, but usually for smaller kids, you know.
Okay. So you mentioned a hybrid model. What should we consider between gas, hybrid, plug-in hybrid, or electric vehicles?
Those are all good choices. I think a couple things that the average person doesn't know, which is that today, a gasoline-only sedan, it wouldn't be remarkable for that car to get 40 miles per gallon. That's common. That's easy to find. Hybrids are more expensive, but they make the fuel economy even more. Plug-in hybrids give you the option of plugging the car in, and it drives like an electric car for the first, say, 30 or 40 miles. So let's just say that every day your errands add up to less than 40 miles, or around 30 to 40 miles. You plug the car in every night, you get up, you drive it, take your kids to school, go to the dog park, go to grocery shopping, go to work, go to whatever you do, and then come home. You just did all that on electricity only. Then when you have a long road trip, and you deplete the electricity that you charged up overnight, the gas engine kicks in and you don't have to worry about stopping to charge. You can just keep driving and gas it up like a normal car.
Okay. So obviously there are a lot of options these days and a lot of new features. So car shopping can get overwhelming. What tips do you have for car shopping, whether it's online or at the dealership?
Well, always start your journey, I guess, for lack of a better word, online. It's just easy. You just sit there and you just start looking at cars. I mean, I don't know how other people work, but I think I sometimes just look at cars on the road while I'm driving and go, oh, that one's ugly. Oh, that one's cool. Oh, that one's too big. Like, that's just a normal thing to do, right?
Yeah.
And you have to like do the research. You can only do so much though, because pictures don't give context. Size and scale matter. So you're going to have to go visit a dealership. You have to go see that car in person and drive it at some point. But you can do all your research ahead of time and figure out the price, the payment, the fuel economy, the features you want, the features you don't want. You can know all of that ahead of time. And this is what I always tell people. When you've decided on a couple of cars that you want to test drive, email them or call them. Treat it as you would treat any serious financial transaction. You would never show up at someone's house and just say, hey, this seems nice. Well, how much is this one? Like, you would plan it, right? And the same with the bank. You wouldn't go to the bank and go, you know, I'm going to deposit this check. And also, can I get a $500,000 loan? You would plan that all out. So the same with cars. Cars are expensive. Email a specific person, call a specific person and say, I want to come down there and I want to have a conversation with you about what's this going to look like for me, as you would any serious financial transaction.
Nice. Okay. So you did mention the website, but let's give it again. Where can listeners go for more information?
Yeah, you can go to kbb.com. That's the website for Kelley Blue Book. And specifically, if you go to kbb.com/awards, you can see many lists and many articles on our most highly regarded cars and the ones that we recommend or that are award-winning vehicles that should help narrow down the list when you're shopping for a newer used car.
Okay, awesome. So once again, kbb.com is the website for Kelley Blue Book, kbb.com. And if you want to look at the awards, the best family cars and other categories, kbb.com/awards will show you the top picks for this year, kbb.com/awards. And we've been speaking today with Brian Moody. He's the executive editor of Kelley Blue Book. And Brian, you're such a wealth of information when it comes to car shopping and the different options that are available out there. So I really appreciate you being here today, sharing your expertise with us and giving the listeners a place to start when shopping for their next car. So thank you so much.
Sure. Anytime. I'm happy to do it. And good luck to anyone who's going to buy a car this weekend.
Every 36 seconds, a vehicle is stolen in the United States. Cars are an important investment, and you have the power to protect it. Remove valuables from your car or place out of view. Roll up your windows completely. Don't leave your car running while unattended, especially during the winter. And always lock your doors and take your keys or fob with you. If you know something about a vehicle theft, call us at 1-800-TEL-NICB.
This is a public service message from the National Insurance Crime Bureau.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Chief Warrant Officer 5, LaShawn White, the first Black Command Chief Warrant Officer in the history of the U.S. Army Reserve Command. This month, the Warrant Officer cohort is celebrating its 106th anniversary, but this important position in the U.S. Army Reserve is one that many civilians have never even heard of. Officer White, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much, ma'am. I'm great to be here.
So what exactly is the U.S. Army Reserve for those who aren't sure?
So the U.S. Army Reserve is part of the three components of the Army, which is the active component, the Army Reserves, and the National Guard.
So what does the Chief Warrant Officer position entail?
Well, the Chief Warrant Officer position within the Army Reserve is where senior leaders, mentors, and advisors to all of the warrant officers across our footprint. So you have a Chief Warrant Officer of the National Guard, you have a Chief Warrant Officer of the Army, you also have a Chief Warrant Officer of the Army Reserve. And we're responsible for assisting leaders with training development, with working with other warrant officers to ensure that policies and programs that affect warrant officers and the Army as a whole are in place.
Why is this career path one of the least known in the Army Reserve?
Oh, great question, ma'am. The biggest reason is that because we're only comprised of 26,000 men and women of the And that's including the Armed Reserve, the active, and the Guard components. No, and that's only 3% of the total Army strength. Our smaller numbers mean that the warrant officers have to be highly trusted in their responsibilities, training soldiers, organizing and advising our missions, and advancing within their career specialties. Now, we may not look like we're large as compared to the other ranks, but we're certainly as important part of the technical foundation of the U.S. Army and Army Reserve.
Okay. So tell us your story of how you rose through the ranks to become the first Black Command Chief Warrant Officer in the history of the U.S. Army Reserve Command.
Great question, ma'am. Like a majority of the Army Warrant Officers, you know, I began my career from advancing from the ranks of private all the way to the sergeant ranks. You know, once I became a sergeant, I was approached by several warrant officers who looked at me and said, you know, you have what it takes to become an Army Warrant Officer. And they encouraged me to join the warrant officer ranks. You know, I was originally driven to join the Army Reserve, you know, for the educational benefits. But I fell in love with the camaraderie that the people who serve our great nation have for one another. So after years of, you know, being an NCO and learning from the beginning, I decided in 2000 that I wanted to be an Army Warrant Officer. And I took the steps and went through the necessary training to become an Army Warrant Officer and then continue to educate myself in that role. And the biggest part of becoming an Army Warrant Officer is that you dedicate yourself to continued years of training and within each specialty. So for myself, I'm an Allied Trades Warrant Officer and an Automotive Technician Warrant Officer. So what I do in those fields is ensure that I am up to date on all processes and all things that come with my job specialty. So if it's equipment, if it's trailers, if it's machining, if it's math. In my allied trades profession, there's a lot of math involved. That means that we all know that it's a losable skill. So you go to school and you learn math, and then next year you take another math test, and the year after you take another math test. You continue to hone your skills to ensure that you're a subject matter expert in your field.
How do warrant officers integrate within their Army Reserve teams?
And the critical positions of the warrant officer is in multiple branches. Right now, the Air Force just adopted warrant officers again. Now, they had warrant officers previously, so the warrant officer ranks within their field went away, and then they brought them back. You know, in the Armed Reserve, the warrant officer has a steady presence and has been around for years. You know, that knowledge helps the Army achieve the Army mission. You know, where the Army has a need for specialized technical experts, you know, that's where you'll find the warrant officers. So you'll find them in systems such as engineering. You'll find them in aviation. You'll find them in even our specialized warfighters. You'll find warrant officers in those corps. And they are the trusted advisors, and they're on the front lines of ensuring the gap, the bridge between our enlisted soldiers and our senior officers. You know, because our numbers are small and as compared to the other ranks, the warrant officers form a unique network of information like no other. We work within a comprised network and consider ourselves like apps. Like you look inside your phone and say, what is the quickest way to a solution? Well, that is the warrant officer. The warrant officer is like an app, and we have an app for that. If it's legal command, we have a warrant officer in the legal ranks. If it's criminal investigation, we have CID warrant officers. So we form ourselves and study our progressive nature of our jobs to ensure that our commanders can get the best answer from an educated source.
Wow, that's fantastic. So where can we go to find out more information about the U.S. Army Reserve and the warrant officer cohort?
Absolutely, ma'am. So you can definitely learn about all the opportunities available in the Army Reserve by visiting usar.army.mil.
Okay, great. So once again, that website, usar.army.mil, that stands for U.S. Army Reserve, usar.army.mil. And we've been speaking today with Chief Warrant Officer 5, LaShawn White. He's the first Black Command Chief Warrant Officer in the history of the U.S. Army Reserve Command, which is celebrating its 106th anniversary this month. And Officer White, it's been great talking to you and finding out your story and more about this position that not a lot of people are familiar with. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, ma'am. It was an honor to be on your call.
Are you looking for more in this world? Are you ready for something bigger? Then we are looking for you. The big-hearted, the bold, the messy and the gutsy. The teachers, the growers, the builders. The skilled, the sharers, the change makers. We need you. We are the Peace Corps. In more than 60 countries, we go all in and all out. We are volunteers, partners, communities, working together, living together, bringing our experience, passion, and joy to building a better world together. From tackling climate change in Mexico to keeping kids healthy in Kenya, from sustainable farming in the Philippines to education in Kosovo, we learn more, give more, share freely, and serve boldly. Are you ready to tackle the tough stuff? To go the distance to make a difference? Then we have a place where you belong. Join us at peacecorps.gov.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bimonthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include Monday, August 5th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Foster Friday Foundation, and Monday, August 19th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Adelson Clinic. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. And the Las Vegas Rescue Mission is holding their annual bottled water drive through August 31st. During the heat of summer, water is crucial for those experiencing homelessness. You can drop off bottled water donations at the Las Vegas Rescue Mission security gate 24/7. To make larger donations or organize a drive, contact Director of Development Heather Williams at 702-320-2089. 702-320-2089. 2089, or find out more at vegasrescue.org. That's vegasrescue.org.